Welcome to the CFG podcast. I'm Glenn Sheldon, and today we're exploring a journey that more and more finance professionals are making, the move from the corporate world into the charity sector. To explore this, I'm joined today by three fantastic guests who've each made that move themselves. Clive McTavish from British Red Cross, Andrew Lowe from Leeds Mind, and CFG's own Sarah Ann Moore. I'd just like you to tell us a little bit about your journey into the charity sector. What drew you to make the move, and what were your first impressions when you arrived? Clive, I'll start with you.
Hi, Glenn. Thanks so much. So my name's Clive McTavish. I'm the CFO of the British Red Cross, but this is my first full-time gig in charity. I had a career in commercial finance before this for the majority of my career. So I started out as an auditor with PwC and then spent 10 years with Pearson, the Financial Times, and then moving into another media organization, Dow Jones, and then into e-commerce with Hotels.com Expedia, which is my first CFO gig there as a divisional CFO there. And it was after that, you know, I had that kind of what am I trying to do with my career moment. And I really wanted to prove myself in a sort of senior governance level, but whilst as well doing something a bit more meaningful. And an opportunity came up with an organization called CDC, which is now British International Investment. It's the UK's development finance company. And so sort of very much a hybrid of a sort of development charitable purpose with also an important, you know, financial goal to make a positive financial return as well. And so that gave me the first step into the world in a kind of hybrid way. And after 4 years of doing that, it felt to me, well, actually going full-time charity would be the thing to do. And so I was sort of looking around and British Red Cross came up as an opportunity. And of course, with my background in international development through CDC, it seemed the natural thing to go for. And I was lucky enough to get it. So that was how I sort of moved through the gears, if you like, to end up here.
What about for you, Andrew?
Hi, Glenn. Thank you for the opportunity to be on the podcast. So I'm currently head of finance and resources at Leeds Mind, which is an independent mental health charity in Yorkshire. I've been working here for about 3 years, but prior to that, I worked at BT. I think it was in the region of 33 years, and I had careers within careers there because I became a finance controller fairly early on in my career, but then was fortunate to be able to move into transformation, business improvement, and then latterly sales, which was a very strange move for a finance professional, but it really built my skills massively. I worked at BT for 33 years and then decided I wanted to go back to school. So at the age of 50, I went to university and I wanted to study something diametrically opposed to the commercial world, which was something a bit more ambiguous. And I ended up studying philosophy, ethics, and religion. And so it was so different from finance, I can't even begin to tell you, but loved it. And then I finished full-time education, did that for 3 years. And then I'm probably going to be quite different from some of the other guests. Clive mentioned about wanting to move into the charity sector. My motive, I'm just going to be brutally honest, I thought it was easy. I thought I'm going to move from the commercial world into a nice little cushy charity job to be able to put my feet up and just stroll slowly into retirement. And I'm sure it'll come out in some of your further questions, but the experience has been very, very different from that. But I'm really pleased to be here.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Yeah, I'm sure we'll explore more of that later. And what about for you, Sarah?
Well, for me, I spent about 19 years in professional services with KPMG, all sorts of finance-based advisory work. So I started the standard route in external audit, technical accounting, then operational internal audit, due diligence, business casework, strategy, finance function review. And I eventually ended up in the US, where I was the US lead director for enterprise risk management and board governance advisory services. So I had a really varied career where I worked with clients, all sorts of organizations, from big global public companies to some NHS work that I did. So really, really varied stuff. But when I came back to the UK, it was a case of, do I go take another role with the firm that I've been with forever? Or do I look to do something quite radically different? And at that point, I really felt that I developed all these skills doing all of these things. And I was a bit of a jack of all trades, which is great. And I wanted to use my skills for sort of maximum good, maximum social impact. So that's really what led me to the charity sector. And this is actually technically my second charity role. I was was a CEO of a regional charity, and I took on a number of trustee roles as well, which has been great. But yeah, it was a really deliberate decision to go full third sector, and it's been fantastic.
Andrew, so you mentioned that about essentially thinking it was going to be easier than it was moving into the charity sector. Is there one thing you wish you'd known before you made the move?
Indeed, yeah. SORP 5.17 and SORP 5.28. I was completely naive when it came to charity accounting. I'd work, obviously worked within BT, very much management accounting, finance controller. I wasn't really involved in regulatory accounting anyway. And that caught me out big time because I started in March, just as we'd gone through year end and we're about to sort of enter audit season. And I was just very naive about the actual regulatory requirements. And SORP caught me out big time. And that caused me to go into a little bit of a spiral for about 6 months, along with my CEO and chairman. So, yeah, I wish I'd known more about SORP.
Thanks, Andrew. And what about for you, Sarah? Was there anything specific that you wish you'd known before you made the move?
I feel like I'm sort of lucky because I came into it eyes wide open. I'd done some pro bono work auditing charities. I'd volunteered with charities before, so I sort of knew what I was letting myself in for. And I really did think the fact that I was a bit of a jack of all trades and I'd got these skills was going to help me, because I thought charities, you have to wear a lot of hats and you're going to have a lot going on. So I was very prepared for that. I think, working in the charitable sector, I love the flexibility. I love the fact that people are super authentic. And I think the way we dress is kind of a representation of that, that we dress for purpose. And yes, that does mean I wear a bit more colour nowadays.
That's great. What about for you, Clive?
So, in truth, when you say, what did I wish I'd known? I think the answer is, I'm glad I didn't really know anything because I think I'd have probably feared it if I'd have known. I mean, I can certainly identify with what Andrew said earlier about, yeah, the sheer volume of stuff and the complexity that comes for it. But I think actually, for me, not really having an anticipation of someone saying, oh, you're going to need this or you're going to think about this, probably played to my strengths, moving between different sectors. It's been a challenging thing to pull off, but moving from media into e-commerce, moving from e-commerce into financial services, completely different, and then moving from financial services into charity again, pretty different. So it means that you just actually gain a lot of skills around asking the right questions, often pretty basic questions. And then listening hard to what people are saying. And I think actually that's what I brought into the equation. So actually, no, I don't know whether if someone had told me what to expect, I would have been better off. I'd have probably only been a bit more scared, actually.
Yeah, a bit of a ignorance is bliss kind of situation. You mentioned the idea of value and wanting to do something meaningful. Sarah, would you say that your sense of the value of your work changed since moving to the charity sector?
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, I have been fortunate that having worked with a diverse range of organisations, particularly the work that I did with the NHS years ago, I mean, I'm fortunate that I've worked on a lot of projects that I remember fondly and I'm proud of outside of the charity sector as well. But definitely working with charities is sort of next level in terms of connection to that social impact. And in my first charity role as CEO of MD Support Centre, as well as in some of my trustee roles as well, I've always had this real and visceral connection to service users on a daily basis in our spaces. And being so close to the output of your work is just absolutely fantastic. And it is something really unique, I think, about being in a charity environment. What we do here at CFG is probably a little bit further away from that physical connection, but the impact that we can have on our members' outcomes is incredibly rewarding. Paying it forward and helping other organisations to do the best that they can with the resources that they can is what inspired me to take this particular role, and it's what I'm really, really excited about.
What about for you, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, I was a little bit naive when I joined Leeds Mind in the charity sector. But my overall observation is for much of my career in finance in BT, it was about using financial skills and disciplines to deliver efficiency. Now, the benefits always went directly to the shareholder. And what I love here is because it's a significantly smaller organisation, if we deliver efficiency here, that benefit goes directly to our clients. And that can literally mean, if we can save £50, a small amount of money, but that means we can deliver a counselling session to somebody who's suffering with mental health. We can change that person's life and we can significantly help them. And that sort of impresses on me every day, to be honest. And it wasn't something I was expecting before I came in, but I love that about working here.
And would you say it's similar for you, Clive?
I mean, you definitely get a different sense of what success looks like here than you do in the commercial world. I mean, it's pretty straightforward in the commercial world. You've probably got a profit target, you might have a turnover target, you might have a cash target. Those things become your mantras, those are your storytelling pieces. And here in the charity world, I mean, it's funny, both the words surplus and deficit, I often think, have a fairly negative connotation when you think about it. Actually, you want to be spending as much as you can, but if you spend too much, you're in deficit, So you're trying to land it on sort of tiny landing space each year. But also, you've got the wider long-term financial stability that is so important. So for me, being able to tell those stories in a different way has been a real interest to me. And I think in terms of value, for me coming in, I think what I really noticed was actually how immature the finance conversation was around the organization as a whole. It just wasn't part of our DNA, the sort of what I had grown up with, the sort of quarterly forecasting, reporting mantras, presenting to the CEOs and CFOs around the place. Just wasn't part of how we managed ourselves, conducted ourselves. And I think actually installing some of that corporate discipline has been, I think, important. So I've been able to sort of see the value of that in terms of helping us navigate through, what have been some pretty horrible waters financially over the last, 3 years since I joined, following the invasion of Ukraine, which of course just, released on us this wave of inflation that still has tremors and impacts today, at a time when, of course, we've got the Iran crisis, which may yet threaten even more of that sort of instability. So it's really important for me to have been able to do that and to, I think, help make the organization just feel a little closer to those, some of the decisions that you have to make when you're at the top of the organization to ensure that stability and the longevity of the organization is preserved.
So I've mentioned there that charities potentially needing to be a bit more disciplined, a bit more corporate-like in some ways. Does anyone else have any thoughts on what charities and businesses can learn from one another, and particularly when it comes to finance, as well as leadership and culture?
One of the things that struck me is, and this is one thing that the third sector can learn from corporates, is what I found is our organization completely underestimates the level of experience and knowledge and expertise that they have within this particular part of the third sector, which is dealing with mental health. And the opportunity for us to, and this may seem odd, but to commercialize and monetize some of that knowledge and experience and expertise really is quite significant. And to actually train other organizations in, workforce well-being, there's so many organizations who are crying out for that type of support to differentiate themselves from other employees in terms of how they look after the workforce. So I think that's a big thing. It's about the overall monetization of things and the corporatization of things. I think another thing we could learn as well is that inevitably in a charity where resources are scarce, resources get spread so thin. And what I mean by that is you may have noticed from the title of my job, I'm head of finance and resources. And what that means is I'm head of digital. And I now genuinely I'm an enthusiastic amateur when it comes to IT. And it's like things get bolted on. And sometimes it is worth investing in expertise in certain areas because the savings can be significant. And I think often when we spread resources too thin, we can suffer the consequences of that.
Sarah, do you have any thoughts on this, either in terms of what charities can learn from corporates or the other way around?
And there is both, right? I think charities for a long time have been leaders in terms of, for example, flexible working practices. Here at CFG, we're remote working first. We offer sector-leading benefits, family-friendly policies, etc. And I think the private sector post-COVID in particular is making some headway with this. But culturally, finding peace with helping people to find more balance in their working lives without impacting productivity, I think that's a journey for all, but it's a real cultural issue for some folks in the private sector to get comfortable with this. And if they don't, you see these back to office mandates, etc. If we don't do that, then there is a potential for loss of talent, albeit perhaps to the charity sector's gain. But I'd echo the comments of colleagues on the podcast with regard to sort of where charities can learn from the private sector. I think in terms of optimizing for monetization and that corporate discipline. But I'd say generally that the private sector's really good at market assessment, strategy, networking, benchmarking, just generally being really outward looking. And I mean, that's a huge role that CFG has to play. But I think from the charity perspective, we can learn so much from each other and having that mindset that we're not in competition and we can share and learn from the experiences of others and just have that sort of very outward looking mindset.
So next one for you, Andrew. You came into the charity sector after 33 years at BT. And one of the first things you did was conduct a detailed benchmarking exercise across expenditure areas. Can you walk us through what prompted that and what you found?
I mean, obviously, I worked in BT for 33 years within the telecoms market. So I had a sort of innate understanding of the marketplace. I had no understanding of the third sector market, and in particular, in terms of serving the mental health community. So it was out of ignorance, really. I needed to understand. I did a deep dive into the P&L and all the management accounts, understood the expenses and the revenues, etc. And it really wasn't rocket science. And I'm not here to suggest anything otherwise. But, all I had for context was A, was a budget, and B, prior year, how much had been spent. So I had no definition of what was good or what was bad. And I was fortunate in a way because Mind, as a national organisation, because we're an independent charity that's an affiliate of National Mind, and there are about 100 local Minds all over the country. And we do have like an online network. So I was able to contact, reach out to other finance colleagues in other Minds who all have very, very similar business models, and create some conversations around trying to initiate a working group for benchmarking. People seem to have a reluctance to be transparent with their information. Didn't understand why, because there's no competition between people. I think it's more of a people seemed reluctant to change to exchange numbers in case theirs were not looked at favorably, I think sometimes, which I found quite bizarre. So basically, I just adopted this, look, I'll show you mine if you show me yours type of approach. So completed an analysis that just looked at about 30 different expense types, looked at the proportions of each individual type relative to revenue and organization size, got some commitment from, I think there was about 10 other organizations that were willing to participate, created all the templates online, and we shared information and shared files. What I found was really critical. I mean, we can all, as accountants, get bogged down with spreadsheets and numbers and data, but this was about attaching the insight to it as well. Like, why are we spending 5% of all our resources on, for example, IT, and somebody else is only expending 2%? And it's about really unpicking that and understanding the detail. But what became evident was across 30 different expense types, 10 different organizations, I then just looked at the outliers. Where were we higher? Where were we lower? Identified what I thought were quick and easy wins. And for us, we seem to be spending significantly more money on IT than other organizations. We unpicked it. We tried to understand the reasons why. And what that precipitated was a re-tender exercise that we completed fairly quickly. We were fortunate in terms of contract endings. And we got a 28% year-on-year saving using the benchmarking information within the whole tender process as well. And it became like almost like an activity list of let's go for telephony, let's go for facilities management. And you can sort of pick things off. And the information became really useful to some of my counterparts as well. Basically, the reason for doing it was because I needed to understand were our numbers good or bad. And it just started the conversation. And it really isn't a complicated process. It's about doing the simple things well sometimes. So, yeah, it worked quite well and it continues to roll forward as well.
Great. And you mentioned about the charities being needing to be open about sharing that data. Do you think that charities could be more transparent about their costs in general? Do you think
100%, because that was the real driver to succeeding on this benchmarking process. It was people being transparent. I mentioned earlier about charities typically spreading the resources too thin. For example, having me as a finance manager and an IT manager as well. I do think suppliers can take the mick out of charities sometimes. I think they can take advantage. I think they believe we're not commercially focused. And I think they can, and I think in the past we have been missold things out of naivety. And I think we could sort of get a lot sharper at that, if I'm honest.
Yeah, that's a good point. And there is a lot of talk around overhead costs in charities, and funders and donors can be often skeptical about money not going directly to the cause. Could more transparency actually help shift that conversation potentially?
I'd say, yeah, absolutely. We are not competitors. We are collective partners in delivering societal value, but we all have similar challenges and we're all having to report. And that reporting isn't always transparent. And you talk about the SORP in this context, but if you look at the accounts of several similar sized charities, you can't necessarily compare directly. It's not always the easiest. And I love Andrew's story because, not everybody is willing to be open and transparent. But I think it's really important because funders expect to see things in a certain way and they want to understand what the overhead situation is. And we want to understand as charities to make sure that we are delivering the very best we can and that we're effective and efficient in the use of our resources. So it's just this incredibly important virtuous circle, I think, really, to make sure that we are deploying funds in the best way. And I can't see anything other than, upside in optimizing management of overheads and working collectively to do the best that we can, really.
Have any thoughts to add, Clive?
Yeah, I think firstly to the point about transparency around overheads. Look, I think it's really important that the charity sector talks about how much it costs to run a charity, but also what it costs in terms of those things that people expect us to have. Now, I work in international development where, the safeguarding conversation really kicked in post Oxfam's challenges there. So what we have now, 10 years on from that, is probably vastly incomparable, probably didn't exist in the way that it's now framed before those incidents. If you look at something like health and safety, there is a natural expectation that people will be spending. If you look at cybersecurity at the moment, the challenges at M&S, challenges at the British Library, showing that it's not the charity sector doesn't get a get out of jail card on this sort of stuff. So these are real costs. And of course, it's important that we talk openly and honestly about those pieces because actually those governance costs cost money. And yet, what do? We compete on a metric of how much money goes directly to the front line, which often is a calculation that you can do in many different ways. We did a survey on this. We found four different ways that charities were using the value of a pound mechanic, depending on whether they included their support costs or not, depending how they calculated how their retail operations that we have, others don't, are used. And also recognizing that some grant-giving organizations, because they don't have operational overheads, look amazingly efficient, but they're just going to be giving money straight through to operational organizations who will then have to have those support costs. So the whole thing is designed to confuse and obfuscate, and it would be lovely to be comparable, but actually it's really important that we tell our own stories as well as we can and actually really knock back on sometimes the comparability that people wish they were there. Now, Andrew's stories are great because they are small scale, low level. He's talking about comparable mind organizations in his area and then things that look similar to that. Now, I'm operating a large charity which has four different social enterprises, which together employ nearly 1,200 people. I've got a massive fundraising team that's looking at UK operations and international operations. I've got those operational activities. My international activities involve both people on the ground, but also grant giving. And to decide that I am comparable to anyone else is just a farce. And actually, then how are you going to judge whether they've judged correctly their health and safety, their safeguarding, their approach to cybersecurity. They're going to have the same culture disciplines that you have. So when you get more complicated, the idea that you can perfectly compare yourself to someone, to me, is for the birds. And then do you trust them more than you trust yourself? And I think actually this is where, as organizations, we've got to look at ourselves and challenge ourselves, because that is where the answer lies within our unique set of circumstances, not a set of circumstances that you can just generically pick up from the world and say, oh, well, therefore our overhead ratio should be X.
I think that's really true. I think it is about telling your own story, isn't it? And being really honest about what it is that you have and what you need. And I think salaries is a great example of where there's a disconnect between we have to have the right staff, we have to have the right talent, but there's still culturally this pushback externally around really paying people for the job that they're doing in the charity sector. And it is that hangover. So we do absolutely need to be honest about what it costs to run a charity today.
That's brilliant. Thank you. All really interesting points. So for you, Clive, over the last 3 years, you've led what sounds like a really significant financial transformation, growing your reserves, launching investment programs, whilst also managing redundancies and reducing the property portfolio. Just how do you hold that all together?
I think the thing when you've gone through a whole period of change, and I'm pretty sure anyone who's been involved in a charity over the last 5 years, since COVID, since Ukraine precipitating massive inflation, will have seen this wave of things just sweep across the financial landscape for charities, national insurance change last year, for example. So these are huge headwinds that you're facing. So I think the first thing for me on joining was really seeing we didn't have a particularly mature approach to telling the financial story, both as a management team and then, like I said, challenging ourselves on it, but also more broadly into the organization. And so I think the first thing as we entered this challenge, and I won't say it was popular, but really was to just talk openly to all staff about the financial situation and explain where we were and explain what we saw were the answers and how we were going to have to approach things. Now, that is unpalatable and it is difficult because, of course, people might be, angry or challenged. The situation we faced, which, like I said, would be faced by others, was just the reality of the times. And it's important that you have that transparency around this is the situation. And I think, generally speaking, within ourselves at the Red Cross, the more we've talked about it, the more people have realized that they can. They can, gnash their teeth, but ultimately these are the challenges. They are real challenges. And of course, we have to respond. We have to make decisions to manage through them, because if we don't, then the organization is it put in peril. So the first thing really was to make sure we were having those transparency calls, the judgments, getting people involved in that conversation. I think the second thing that we were particularly facing was this big transition in our funding mix. For a long time, we had very generous general fund supporters who would give us monthly donations, £20 or so on. And by having thousands of those, you build up a great wave of money from that source. You have legacy sources, you have, general funds donations coming in from other givers. You had a lot of money there, which allowed us to fund a lot of activities directly through that source before we even got into restricted funding. Now, actually, what's happened with the change, the massive high inflation, if you look at something like the real living wage, it's gone up 36% over the last 4 years. Well, my general to funds donations haven't done anything like that. I mean, they've broadly been flat. So, of course, you've got this changing dynamic. And one of the things for us has meant, okay, well, we've got to make that restricted money work harder for us. We've really got to talk about things in a different way. We've got to learn to tell the stories about those activities that we used to fund through general funds, now in a restricted funding landscape. And we've got to tell our staff that the things they used to sort of be able to go and pitch for, it's like, well, you've got to put those head to head against those core things that we really want to do. And that's been difficult again, because people were like, oh, I thought I could always just go and raise some money for something else. It's like, no, that thing that you've always just had funded in this way, we've now got to make sure we can fund it through restricted donations, through talking to donors, talking specifically about those activities. So that's been a real change for us. We've also had to change narratives, the things that we never had to previously worry about: gift aid following donations, interest on monies, CTC as a conversational topic. All of these things have been things that previously we didn't have to worry about so much, and suddenly you've had to put front and center and go, okay, these are mechanics to try and help recover the costs of the organization. And as we talked about earlier, talking openly about what it costs to do safeguarding or cybersecurity or health and safety have become a really important part of the narrative, both to donors but also internally again, because people say, well, why should I be asking this donor for 12% CTC? Oh, that's terrible. We don't charge as much as XYZ. And I'm like, because we've got to learn. We need to learn how to tell our stories, how to explain to someone what it costs, the investments that we're making in those areas, that if they went wrong, people would be horrified that we didn't have the spend. But when everything's fine, oh, they expect that spend to go away. No, we just have to keep reminding and telling people that this is what it costs to operate in some of the most dangerous and difficult parts of the world. People have to understand that, yeah, that comes with a necessary part of the cost. So I think we've had that sort of change. And so navigating those pieces has been important. And then finally, I think for me, part of this is about how we've talked about changing working patterns. And of course, there is CFG working entirely remotely. Well, of course, the BRC has also moved to a very hybrid way of working. We don't use the properties that we have across the country in the same way. And so actually that did afford us the opportunity to then look at those leases, those freeholds, and go, right, we just need to be a little more opportunistic and responsive here. So actually exiting properties for us has created capital income, which has been great in two ways. Obviously, it's reduced the operating costs of that estate, but equally it's freed up money for us to invest in technology. And when you look at the technology stack, fundamentally, that's one of the things internally that people most get anxious about. Oh, we can't do this, we can't do this. I had someone join the fundraising team who said, oh, I've never seen that done on Excel before. I had someone in the operations team who talked about still sending letters in for reports into head office. And you're like, right, okay, clearly we need to invest here. But how to create the capital? Well, exiting the property, which again wasn't popular because some people would use buildings and they'd say, oh, well, that's our local place. So again, being able to make sure people could see those trade-offs and then directly link it through to the two major investment capital programs we're making at the moment has been an important part, again, of telling that story so that people can, particularly non-financial people, can really understand there is a direct connection between exiting a property and investing in new systems to resolve that problem that they thought was never going to get resolved. So, again, that's the sort of wide sweeping narrative. But, those are probably three of the core things that we've done to try and make that transformation a success.
You've also spoken about aligning finance with strategy and impact so that they're intrinsically linked rather than siloed. What would you say that looks like in practice?
Yeah, thank you. So, look, I'm now helping look after BRC strategy as well as impact as well as finance. Now, it was interesting to me to find that they weren't natural bedfellows when I joined. And actually, what was really confusing then was that we seemed to have two planning processes. We had a strategic planning process, and separately, we seemed to have a finance planning process, as if these things were in some way not connected. Well, of course, everyone knows that those things are intrinsically connected and then impact on the back end of, well, what are we trying to do and measure? So these things are all intrinsically linked. So actually just bringing them together so that the teams can feed off each other and understand those elements, but absolutely getting a firm financial foundation at the start of both the impact conversation and the strategy conversation is really important. And then you go off in your separate ways, but actually keeping close around those pieces is so important. I mean, when you look at strategy within the charity sector, I mean, Andrew said it's really important for us to understand our position. What are we doing compared to others? Do we really understand whether we are unique, duplicative, or whatever? It's strength, but a weakness is the fact that we don't do mergers and acquisitions very often. It's a very rare beast in the corporate world. Takeovers and that sort of activity really dominate, and it means that you get this sort of drive of efficiency and market analysis, market dominance or competitiveness because you've sort of consolidated. And actually, here within the charity, so we don't do that. And thus, it's really important that actually we understand, well, what is the unique thing that we are trying to do? Because it's a pretty daft world. And if we're both going after the same sorts of people trying to offer similar sort of solutions, and then effectively worried why only four people have turned up and four people have gone to someone else's thing. And you're like, well, we could have managed more people. So it's really important that we understand what are we trying to do, how it fits in with others, so that we've got that unique, that critical understanding of that activity. And then that flows into how we tell the story through the impact, the metrics that we are using, whether they're consistent, whether they make sense, and whether that story again, can resonate with the donors that we have in the sector. So I think it's really important for me that we've joined up those elements together. And I'm continuing to push again some of that corporate approach to how you think about strategy to take it beyond the very high level. Oh, we exist because of this purpose. You know, what I learned in coming into charities, people would call that a strategy and they would spend ages wordsmithing the statement. Well, I never spent any time wordsmithing statements when I was running strategy at the FT or at hotels.com. You're all about operational. What are we doing? How's the balance of our activities? You know, marketing competitiveness. What are the key elements, you know, in terms of our product, our service, etc. I think charity, we've got to think in the same way. We've got to be doing that thought process. And that's now what we're pushing ahead in the Red Cross to try and make ourselves smarter in that way.
Thanks, Clive. Andrew, do you have any advice for people looking to make the move from the corporate world into the charity sector?
Don't underestimate it. Don't underestimate it in terms of the demands of the role. Don't underestimate the skills, experience, and talent of the people that work within the organisation. The charity sector is not a second choice to the corporate sector. It's just different. And the other thing is, don't underestimate the rewards you can feel from investing your time and efforts into something that goes to the benefit of your clients as opposed to shareholders. So I would encourage people to make the move. But I sort of recognise what Clive said about you're probably better off not knowing, because sometimes it might be easier.
I feel like the optimist on this call, so I'd say do it, definitely. That would be my advice. But I very much agree with Andrew that it's important not to underestimate what you're getting yourself into. And I actually had a friend who asked me this question very recently, and they were a very senior executive in a Fortune 500 company with really transferable skill set, but quite concerned and nervous about how to move into this completely new sector. So my advice was get to know the sector, get comfortable, ideally by finding a cause that you're passionate about and applying for a trustee role. So my advice was that their skills would be incredibly valuable at that trustee level, and it would give them the opportunity to figure out if the sector was something that they wanted to enter, and an absolute win-win in terms of them sort of having that experience and being able to contribute to an organisation along that sort of training development pathway. And the outset of that is that they are now a trustee of a homelessness charity and enjoying the experience. So I think being a trustee is a great way to get a sense of the sector before you jump into a professional role.
I'm going to go back to something Andrew said right at his beginning, which was this sort of strange sense that, yeah, he thought it was going to be easy, and actually it turned out to be really hard. And I think that is an experience that a number of people have repeated to me over the time. And I think, did I think the same thing? I wasn't quite sure. But absolutely, I think the thing that struck me has been, you know, now I'm nearly 3.5 years in, and the complexity still continues sometimes to overwhelm me. And, you know, do I think I've got a handle on all aspects of the organization? I mean, here we are talking about, you know, finances, strategy. You know, we haven't even talked about the 10,000 volunteers we have and how to make the most of them and how they fit into the whole of it. I mean, you know, it's just so many pieces of the equation at an organization like the British Red Cross. So, yeah, it really is challenging, and it forces you constantly to think in a different way. But absolutely, I think when it comes down to it, it is that you know you're making a difference. You know it's important, and you know that actually when you sit in a CFO chair, you have a really important chance to influence, stabilize, help success, freeing up money, making a saving to make a difference. Absolutely, these parts feel so much more important than, just driving shareholder value, which might have, made you richer in terms of your own finances, but probably didn't make the world a richer place in terms of its sort of joy for everyone. So I think really having that as part of your package, because absolutely, you're not going to be earning as much as you would have done, could have done if you were in the commercial sector. But I think the chance to feel part of something bigger, more important, something that is probably touching the lives of people, either in your local area or nationally or internationally, is something that really, does feel really important and powerful. And yes, you can go and be a trustee, but actually, getting in there and recognizing that your skills can be super valuable. I think, certainly the disciplines that Andrew and I have talked about the commercial world, are really transferable and important. But I think also you do learn good listening, good observation. You learn to tackle different problems. And you find this all the way through the charity world. It is not a straightforward equation of, right, let's generate this profit. No, you're trying to generate impact. How are you measuring the impact? So all of these questions are so difficult to answer. But actually, how we people, when you put finance into the equation and make it part of that stakeholder discussion, you get these trade-offs. You help guide people better. You help sort of push that. Well, how's that valuing? Is that money better spent over there rather than over there? I mean, that's such an important prompt into those discussions, which often, when we talked earlier about, strategy and impact being separate, probably weren't part of that conversation. So, yeah, there's huge amounts that commercial finance people can bring into the charity world. And I'd love to talk to anyone more about it. And you can find me on LinkedIn.
And lastly, for you, Sarah, as CFG's Finance and Operations Director, you're now sitting at the heart of the charity finance community. And what are you most excited about in your new role? And what do you hope to bring to it?
Well, I've talked already about what my motivation was really in terms of helping to grow CFG and really help charities to deliver the great work that they're doing ultimately. And I'm still pretty new, so I've probably spent more time so far on our own digital transformation and continuous improvement journey. We're doing a lot operationally and internally at the moment, but I think what's really driving me, what I'm really excited for the next piece is to really pick up our finance journey framework, which we're working hard to integrate into all aspects of what we do and how we articulate the criticality of finance to strategy and how it can deliver and support the delivery of charity mission. So, in short, that's my next area to really dive into. And as I mentioned, I did a lot of finance function review in the past. And so I have these sort of skills and this real passion and enthusiasm to help others. And I'm really excited to get stuck into that piece. And also, of course, deliver all that we need to on our digital transformation, which is ongoing right now.
That's great. Thank you. So we've covered a huge amount of ground today, and I want to thank Clive, Andrew, and Sarah for such a rich and interesting conversation. The move from corporate to charity finance is rarely straightforward, but what comes through clearly from all three of our guests is that the skills gained in the private sector can be genuinely transformative when applied in the charity context. So thank you, Andrew.
Welcome.
Thank you, Clive.
Thanks, Ben. Great to be here.
And thank you to Sarah.
Thank you.
You can find more information about CFG membership benefits, professional development opportunities, and upcoming events on the CFG website. Thanks for listening, and until next time.